Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent, are archived on the website. The rest of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station, which is blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Okay, thanks. Now let's get started. Now tonight we are going to talk about maintaining control. And I think that perhaps the first question that we're going to think about is who should control the meeting? Who should control the meeting? Now, I would say it's me. No. Now, thank you very much. We've already got quite a bit of participation. And quite a few people are saying, including Gail and others, are saying that it's the host that should control the meeting because the meeting needs a leader or it will never have focus. So a lot of you think that we should control the meeting because usually we're thinking about being a host, about being the leader of the seminar, the workshop, the meeting, the mediation, whatever it is that we're doing. The host should control the meeting so that we can have focus and work together and so that you can maintain some control, so that we have the control. Now, I am getting... I always say I learn something on these shows, and I hope you do too, and I'm getting quite a difference of opinion on our first question for this show, who should control the meeting. Now, a lot of you are saying, including Meryl and other people, thank you very much for your participation, that the host, we, control the meeting, the leader. But other people are saying the opposite. They're saying that everyone should have the ability to control the meeting, that the meeting is controlled in a democratic way. And, for example, Don says that negotiations are not grammar school and the grammar school teacher is not in charge. It's a democratic process and everyone participates equally. Everyone participates equally. Now, that's interesting because this means that a lot of you think that the meeting is run by the participants and there's no single leader in control. You might be the host, of course, but you've merely picked the venue and that it's a democratic process and everyone is equal. And I'm about to say what all of you think I say, and I get lots of emails that say, you always say it depends. But you know what? I think it kind of does. It depends how many people are in the process, how many people are in the room. If there's lots, you might need a leader. It depends how complex the issues are. And it depends of whether everyone is really basically in accord and you're just ironing out the minor issues and there's no real dissension in the room. It's not too complex because everybody pretty much feels the same. It's just that you're trying to decide how to proceed so that you can effectuate change, perhaps with a law or something that requires some procedural questions. But you're all of the same mind. If that's true, then yes, of course, you don't need a leader as such, and everyone is an equal participant, and there's no one who needs to assert control, right? No one needs to assert their leadership, because you're all truly are equal, and you're all a naturally convivial group because you're all of the same mind, you're all of the same opinion, basically speaking, and you're just trying to figure out the way to get something done. So that's interesting. A lot of you agreeing with that. You say that everyone, that in order to maintain control, everyone needs to be equal. That's an interesting point. You know, a lot of people in this kind of a democratic concept of equal participation, Tika and other people have mentioned the fact, and thank you very much for your participation. I love hearing from you. And Tika and others have mentioned that in order to make a democratic process where everyone is an equal participant, you might need a leader who maintains control in order to influence the outcome, in order to keep everyone focused and going forward. But you could vote, the people in the room could vote on who will lead the conversation. And that, and Tika and others are saying that if you do such a thing, that the people in the room, the participants, will respect an elective leader more than one that is self-designated. That people respect an elected leader more than one who is self-designated. Well, again, I'm going to say it depends, because I think it depends also on the group again. And whether, if you're going to have a long, drawn-out process that is acrimonious, like a political process, you might think about maybe you shouldn't have a vote and waste a lot of time. But if it looks like you can, and you can vote, and people would be more satisfied if someone wasn't just chosen, because who chooses? Well, it's kind of self-designated, isn't it? And that participants could vote and choose a leader, equal participants. Now, I see some people, Justin and others, who are telling me that they actually do something that I have never done, and I don't know if it's a good idea or not, really, because, you know, there are no rules to the recipe for peace now concept. It's whatever works, whatever is reasonable, whatever is good with the group and with the issues and the complexity that you're dealing with. Our role is to get you to think through the complexities and think through what you're doing so that you reach a reasonable conclusion that will cause the group that you are in, the process that you are in, to go forward and accomplish their goal. See, there are no set rules, because quite a few, well, not quite a few, but a lot of people are going for the we vote for who's going to be the, who's going to have control over the meeting. And Justin and several others have said that they vote every meeting. We vote each meeting based on expertise and past experience, is what he says. Vote each meeting based on expertise and past experience. Well, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? And I'm getting quite a bit of agreement here that people think that they have done that, and people are telling me that they vote each meeting because as you progress step by step towards your goal, in order to maintain control and in order to have focus and a reasonable stepping forward, as the issues get resolved, different people have more expertise on different issues. And that's a very good point, that the leader, the person who maintains control and gets us towards our goal, should have some expertise in the issues. Some expertise in what to do, some past experience. And that might change depending on what issue you're dealing with, if you have a rather complex question. A very interesting point. You vote each meeting based on expertise and past experience. Wow, that's an interesting idea. Thank you, Justin. And all of you who have participated and who have said that that's what you do, thank you. That's very interesting. I don't usually do that. Usually I think that there is a leader, but that's a good point about complex issues. that someone could have expertise down the line. And a lot of you are telling me that in order to have a leader really exert control, if you don't have a group that's of one mind, an extremely a cohesive group, that everyone in the process is pushing forward for the same thing in the same basic way, that they get an impartial third party, an outsider. And, you know, I do that a lot. That's what I do for a living. I do mediation. I do business mediation. And an outsider impartial third party is oftentimes, and I'm getting a lot of agreement, is oftentimes a very good thing. And the disagreement that I'm getting from you, thank you for all of your participation. People are saying that they don't use an outsider because of the expense. It's an economic decision. And that's a really good point, too, because, of course, if you have to hire an expert or an attorney or someone who is an experienced negotiator as an independent third-party outsider, it will indeed help. It does indeed get the group focused if the person is good, but it is an expense, and it is an ongoing expense because you keep needing to do it to get through the issues. And, you know, people are saying that an expert is worth the expense. For example, Paul says that an expert outsider can handle the information and inform of the facts, science, laws, etc. And it's a good point that an impartial third-party expert could be invaluable to the negotiation, could really tell us, keep us on the... Well, you know, I know this is a global show, and I don't like to use American idioms, but there's an expression that goes on the straight and narrow to keep us on the path and keep us moving forward, because sometimes you can get bogged down in arguing some issues which in reality have no bearing on the situation. For one reason or another, they are against the law, that science doesn't prove it, whatever it is, but you don't want to get bogged down in something that truly has no worth, is not going to get us towards our goal. And you know, I think that that's going to lead us to our next question, because a lot of people are asking it already. We've talked about who should have the control, who should maintain control over the process so that we can get a successful outcome. But a lot of people are asking the next practical question. Thank you very much. It's great because these shows kind of evolve organically. And the next question that's being asked is, how should the leader maintain control? We've decided that we're going to have someone who leads us, or everyone's going to participate equally. But how should this be done is now the question. And, you know, several people, including Kyle and others, thank you for your participation, says that the leader maintains control by being the deciding vote, that it's that when it comes down to making a decision, the leader is the person who is the deciding vote, and therefore they have quite a bit of control. I'm getting quite a bit of dissension with that concept because, of course, most of us don't want to be that leader who has the deciding vote. And a very valid point is being made that having the deciding vote makes you kind of a dictator for big issues. And, you know, if you're going to do that, a lot of times the results will not be very good because people will refuse to act if they've been dictated to. The deciding vote, Kyle says the deciding vote, and it's a real good point, the deciding vote is especially good for minor issues, what he's referring to as housekeeping procedures, like minutes and the order of speaking and the order of going to eat and like that. And, well, I agree, and we've got this is interesting. A lot of people agree about the minor issues, but now we're taking issue. Now we are thinking about what is a minor issue. I think a minor issue is truly a procedural one. Takes the vote on, kind of gets together the date when most people can come. You see, that's a housekeeping, it's a procedural issue. And makes a decision depending on how many people can come on a certain date or a certain time. The leader might take notes of some sort, procedural issue. And, you know, Ryan and others are saying that the order of doing things is not a minor issue, like the order of speaking. That could be touchy. Now, it depends. Look, I said it again. It depends on your group and whether or not people are vying to take the floor first. And then when the discussion heats up, when you've got, we won't call it a dispute, but when you've got a more heated discussion, somebody has to take turns, because we can't all yell at each other at once, right? We'll lose control. And the idea is to maintain control, of course. And it's, you have to have a way of taking turns. And this is why we've discussed this in prior shows. By the way, for those of you who weren't here at the very beginning of this show, thank you very much for all of the returning people. I see a lot of familiar names. But those of you who are new or don't remember, the last five shows are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And all the shows, including those five, are archived on the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. I mention this because we've talked about maintaining control in the sense of not letting people start to get angry and disruptive. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we all learned to do, and we remember to do, I hope, is to have a set of ground rules. In fact, Kim and others are referring to the ground rules that we talked about, and ground rules of civility, we'll call them, and respect for the other people in the room. And that is another way of maintaining control, is to politely remind people and enforce the ground rules, the rules of civility and of taking turns and of not using bad language and of not shouting at each other and other things like that. And, of course, that is one of the reasons that when you get to that point, oftentimes people are using the word time out. And this is a global show, but everyone, I hope, knows that a time out is a break, that you have to kind of make a break during the process so that we can all cool down and not continue arguing vehemently and getting kind of unreasonable. And that is actually the reason that Recipe for Peace Now advocates the use of food, right? Because it makes for a convivial time out. It's not because we're hungry. It's because we need to take three deep breaths and have a sip of something and a bite of something nice and calm down and think it through before we do something that will prevent the process from going forward. Because oftentimes we don't want to have it fail. It's just that in the heat of the moment, we've gotten excited, you see. And, you know, Kim and others are saying that if you're going to have turns and you're going to decide who speaks first and there's some contention and everybody wants to speak first, that the best thing to do is something that I frequently do, And the best thing to do is to do something that is obviously impartial, like flipping a coin. Heads or tails, flipping a coin? That in order to know who it is that is going to go first. Because oftentimes that's in contention. And it's not that big a deal, but you know how things get to be a big deal when we're negotiating and when we're doing a seminar or workshop or there's some hard feeling on one side or the other. You see, flipping a coin in front of everybody is real, real easy, and it's real definite that it's fair. It's chance, and then you don't appear biased. And Alan and others are mentioning that oftentimes the leader, the host, or even everyone, if everyone's equal, that the easiest thing to do is to maintain control is to be a timekeeper and use an actual timer so that everyone can see that they have had the same amount of floor time, the same amount of speaking time as everyone else. So I actually use a timer so that everyone can see it and not just my watch, because then people feel that maybe you gave someone else an extra 2 minutes because it seemed like they were talking longer than they had the ability to talk. Mm-hmm. And then it gets rid of the question of how to decide. And Pascal, another, this is interesting. I do indeed think a set time limit is a really good thing. And sometimes people don't use all the time, right? And sometimes people try to go over. Now, some people are saying they don't use an actual timer because it's hard to cut someone off who's being reasonable in mid-sentence, in mid-thought. A lot of people are a little more verbose than others, and it's hard for them to stick to a short period of time. And Pascal and others are saying that they give a 3-minute warning and like that, but I think it's hard to be flexible about the time, because then you get into bias. Whose argument is more reasonable than someone else's? Well, that goes to my opinion, right? And that's not fair. So I think an actual set timer is a good thing. A lot of people are disagreeing and saying it is intrusive and that you should just give a 3-minute warning so that the person wraps up their thoughts and their argument, and that the actual tick, 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 tick of the timer is annoying, and it's not a good idea. I like it because everyone can see that they're equal. And I don't always use it, of course, because, well, yes, you're right. I'm going to say it again. It depends on the group. And, here's an interesting point that several people have made. Kevin and others say that you naturally exert control over the surroundings if you choose the venue. How? That goes to our question of how to maintain control. How? And he says that you naturally exert control over the surroundings if you choose the venue. And that's a good way to start, to have control over the surroundings. Control literally over the surroundings, as well as you've probably set it up and gotten it together if you've chosen the venue. And you've got some control about how it looks and how it feels. Quite a few people are talking about the selection of participants. And that's a really good point. So that's going to be our next question, because that goes to maintaining control too, doesn't it? And the next question is going to be how. Now we've talked about who, and we've talked about how they maintain, but let's think about this question. How are the participants chosen? That goes to maintaining control, right? Because if you pick your participants, then you pick people that perhaps you think you can get to form a conclusion, get to maintain a wee bit of control over them so that the process can be successful. So the question is, how are participants chosen? Now, well, that's an interesting point. And, well, quite a few people are saying that participants should be chosen on the basis of their expertise, on whether or not they know something and can bring something of value to the process. They are an expert in something. It doesn't even have to be an expert as in a degree, a college degree or something. It could be someone who has a great deal of experience. They're an expert. They're basis of their expertise. And so that seems to be number one, how participants are chosen. Got quite a few people agreeing with that. Excuse me. And also, now people are saying also that participants are chosen by the enthusiasm shown because they have been community leaders. That's a good point. Yes, enthusiasm. And who's a community leader? Community leaders are usually very enthusiastic, and they are probably experts in the issues involved. There's a very practical vein amongst you. That's very nice. Thank you for all of your participation. Quite a few people are saying that they don't choose participants. The participants are those people who are necessary because of their position. Their position in an organization, in a government, or their position, what job they hold, so to speak. And yes, people say it's not necessarily even a job. It's they could be their position as a religious leader, or a cultural leader, or a social leader. But a lot of you are saying that you don't really get to choose your participant, that it is chosen by the position they hold. Necessity because of position. And those of you who think you can choose your participants, look for reasonableness and the ability to work well with others, team players. Yes, these are all excellent traits to look for if you can choose your participants. And Gabriel and others are saying that you choose the participating organizations due to the interest and to need, and then the organizations, you let them choose a representative. So you have to have some organizations at the table, because of what they do, what their position is in the community, and you allow the people in those organizations, possibly the head of the organization, to choose a representative to come to negotiate, to mediate, to the workshop, to the seminar, to whatever it is you're doing. You ask the organization to supply the proper person, right? And, you know what? A lot of people are saying that the problem is really not in choosing the participants, but in how to unchoose, how to dismiss a disruptive participant or a non-participant participant. I've got quite a few people asking about what do you do when someone refuses to participate, even though they said they would, and they're sitting right there, and they represent an organization whose viewpoint, or a group, or themselves, they are a viewpoint that is important to the process. But they don't do it. So how do you unchoose a participant? Let's phrase this question. How do we maintain control and affect the results by changing the participants? How do we maintain control and affect the results by changing the participants? Oh, this is sneaky. I love it. Mary says that the best way to do that, to change participants, is to pick a time when the unresponsive participant can't come. I love it. You figure out what bridge night is, and you pick that night for the meetings because you pick a time when the unresponsive participant can't come. I love it. That's practical. But what if you can't do that? What if they insist and you don't know when their Wednesday night event occurs? And we've got quite a few people that are saying that you can ask the organization, Arlen and others, thank you for your participation, that the thing to do is to ask the organization who sent their representative, who is now proving less than ideal to the process, that you can ask that organization to send a substitute representative. You could just say, you could ask them to please send someone else. If that is viable, if you can do that reasonably and it will work, that's an excellent idea. I've done that. I've said, well, you know, they're not coming, they're not participating, we're not, you know, perhaps someone else could come. If it's a big enough organization, you could be gracious and say that you would like someone from a different department, if that's possible, and not say that this person is unsatisfactory as a participant, but just say that you need different expertise. You see, that's nicer. And then you won't have animosity, because you never know when you're going to see that other person again. And you don't want to be ungracious. It's just that, wow, they're not working out in this particular group. And a lot of people are saying that you should just plain ordinary throw them out. You should throw them out and ban them from the process, according to Arlen and others. Throw out and ban from the process. Well, it depends. You knew I was going to say that. Because the answer is yes, you can do such a thing, although I don't generally like to. I try to be more gracious. But you can certainly do such a thing unless that person is very important to the process. That person is very high up in an organization that you are bringing to the table. That person is important to you. That person is important to the process, and therefore you can't throw them out. So, yes, if you can, in a nice way, please, you can indeed recommend that people not be disruptive, and if they continue to do so, perhaps they would like to go elsewhere. But that's only for people that are not definitive, not necessary for the process. You see, yeah, sometimes you're stuck with your participants, and you just have to get around them, and you just have to encourage them to go towards consensus. And you know, people are saying that the thing to do is to privately speak with a disruptive participant. And I think that's true. You can also enlist the assistance of others, especially others in the participants' circle of influence, in their circle that they go in, so that someone else perhaps can ask them to be more responsive and receptive to the process and show them that it's important. You know, a lot of people are saying that what I'm talking about is peer pressure, the pressure exerted by your peers that you so that you do something. And I suppose it is. To a certain extent, there's some peer pressure in everyday life, right? We look around at what others are doing, and we decide if we think it's a good thing. So that's, you know, if you enlist the assistance of others to influence the participant, especially assistance of others in the disruptive participants group, in their, well, ethnic, religious, cultural, work, whatever kind of group it is, if you enlist someone to talk to them from that group, it's a good thing. It's oftentimes effective. Or, as a lot of people are mentioning, you could privately take the person aside, especially if you think that they didn't mean it. that it's not a malicious act. It's merely a personality trait. Sometimes people have that. They have a personality trait like that, and they don't realize that they're being disruptive. Or at least they say they don't, and hopefully after the private conversation, they're not anymore. And so these are all ways to establish, and also a lot of people are telling me that if you establish the rules up front and do them early, you need to be consistent in enforcing them so that everybody knows the repercussions for leading the group astray into a disruptive manner that prevents us from maintaining control and getting a positive result. So the rules ahead of time. And then, of course, people are talking about the time out before the participant gets out of hand, gets kind of wild and doesn't want to be in the team, you see. And of course, yes, people are asking, and thank you very much for all of your participation. And it was very interesting because there was quite a difference in opinion for this one. Sometimes we're all kind of the same mind on these shows, and this time we had some difference of opinion. How nice. Thank you very much for participating. We are indeed heading towards our food portion of this show. Yes, we are. And people go, is it recipe time? Yes, it is. And before, of course, that we talk about the recipes, and those of you who have been here before already typing in label, yes, this is true. I'm going to say what I always say, but it's very important, and I keep kind of reinforcing it, and especially since we have quite a few new listeners. It is very important if you're going to have a potluck, if you're going to have any kind of food at one of these get-togethers, meetings, seminars, workshops, speeches, whatever it is you're doing, if there's food, it needs to be labeled. And not just what is it, but what is in it. Because people have all kinds of restrictions. They have dietary restrictions. They have allergy restrictions. And social, cultural, I don't do that kind of, maybe even religious restrictions concerning food. And you don't want to make anybody sick or offended or not have a good time. So you need to ask everyone to tell what is in the food because it's not always obvious. Now we're going to talk about a safe recipe and an adventure recipe. And what makes something a safe recipe? Yes, thank you for those of you who are actually answering these kind of rhetorical questions. But a safe recipe, and those of you who have been here before know that I think that the host, which is us, I think that there should be spare food, extra food, and that you should have something that most people can eat. And when you set up the get-together, you will indeed have emailed, called, however process you're using, and asked people about their dietary, religious, and other restrictions, and allergic restrictions. You're going to ask them first, and you're going to tell everyone so that nobody does something bad and brings something that people can't eat and, God forbid, is a big surprise. So we're going to not only label our food, we're going to have some spare food. And the next recipe is this recipe, the first one, is the safe recipe. Why is it safe? It's safe because there are not too many exotic ingredients. Most people have seen these things. And generally speaking, what is in this dish does not trigger allergies or religious or cultural or dietary problems. With the first one's going to be a vegetarian curry. Very delicious, and I'm not giving you big amounts. You can make giant amounts and refrigerate it or bring it or whatever. You can make a big bowl. This is not I'm not telling you enough food for a really big bowl. You modify the recipes, of course, depending on how many people are coming. But here we go. We're going to have 2 tablespoons of oil, 2 onions that we're going to chop, 2 garlic cloves that we're going to crush. Yes, people say I use a lot of garlic in my food. Probably true. You know this can all be modified. 2 teaspoons of grated ginger. Yes, it's delicious in the curry. 2 teaspoons of chili powder. You want it less chili-like? Put in less chili powder. 2 teaspoons of mustard seeds. Yes, with the ginger and the mustard and the curry, yummy. We're going to slice up kind of medium-thick 3 carrots. 6 ounces of green beans, chopped. If you can get the fresh, that is very, very nice. If not, you know, of course, to thaw and drain any kind of refrigerated. A 16-ounce can of crushed tomatoes. About 3/4 of a cup of vegetable stock. 2 of those small eggplants that you can slice, make nice little round slices. 2 zucchini, the same idea, to make nice little round slices that are kind of medium in thickness. 2 pounds of pumpkin. Oh, the pumpkin's delicious. Now, you know, of course, that I'm in the States. So whatever it is that I give in these recipes is pretty much things that can be found in the States that are readily available to me. Now, pumpkin is kind of seasonal out here. And pumpkins are also hard to cut into. This is a great recipe if you've got a lot of pumpkin left because you made a jack-o'-lantern. But if not, and you drain it very, very thoroughly, you can use canned pumpkin. And the best thing to use is the frozen chunks of pumpkin. Also, the same idea, thaw, drain very carefully. Drain real thoroughly and pat them dry. And about a 16-ounce can of chickpeas that we're going to rinse and drain, and we're going to rinse them because, of course, pardon me, we're going to take the little shells. It's not really shells, it's that little skin that's on chickpeas on the canned ones. You want to wash that all off because you don't want it floating around in your curry. Yes, to those of you who are asking if you can use fresh, of course you can always use fresh. It's just that in the United States it is easy to come by frozen in a can. Of course, if you use fresh beans that are hard like that, you need to soak up overnight and make them edible. Make them nice. Okay. So, and yes, if you use more fresh than I do, it'll probably be even better. So we're going to heat the oil in a really big frying pan, and we're going to cook the onion for about 5 minutes, or until it gets nice and translucent. Then we're going to add the garlic, the ginger, and the spices. That's the mustard seeds. And we're going to cook for another couple of minutes until it all incorporates and everything smells yummy. This is one of those recipes that will be wonderful in the house, and you could even make it together if you wanted to group a project for your participants. Now, we've got the spices and the onion and the oil, and it's all very fragrant. We're going to add the carrot, the beans, the tomato, and the stock, and we're going to stir it all around and incorporate, and we're going to bring the whole thing to a boil. Then turn down the heat and simmer it for about 10 minutes more. So everything is really cooked through. Then we're going to add, now if you're using fresh chickpeas, they may be harder in consistency. If you're using canned, you can adjust when they go into the hot water. Now after we've already gone to a boil and we've simmered, we're going to add the eggplant and the zucchini. And then we're going to take our pumpkin cubes and add that too. Usually frozen pumpkin is a little bit more soft. You might need to add that at the very end. But do add it so that it remains a cube and it gets cooked through real thoroughly and is nice and hot. Okie dokie. Now we're going to take this whole thing and we're going to simmer it. We're going to cover it and simmer it until it is nice and tender. Now, if you've used canned chickpeas, put them in now. If you've used fresh chickpeas, put them in before, depending on how hard they are. Because the green beans can take it, the chickpeas can't because they need, like the pumpkin, they need to be whole in the curry so that it looks pretty and not turn into squish. So that's all we do. You add the chickpeas and the pumpkin at the last minute if they are of more soft and already pre-cooked consistency. You cook it again for about 10 minutes. Delicious. The whole thing didn't take very long. Everything got put into the same pot. It makes an absolutely lovely curry. We're going to serve it with a big bowl of rice, just plain rice on the side, so that people can determine how much rice they like and how much curry they'd like. And that is the safe recipe because there's nothing in it that people are usually allergic to. Someone can eat garlic, leave it out. But it's vegetarian, and it has a lot of items in it that are easily procured, and most people have eaten before, so that they know if that's something that's forbidden or not. So that's our safe recipe. Very lovely, very fragrant, and if you prep, well, even not, you can even slice and put this together as a group if you have the kitchen facilities. It is a lovely bonding exercise, and it smells good right away. Everybody likes it, and there's a lot of chopping-type prep, but not any pre-cooking. And chopping is, it can be a group activity. So that's good, slicing and chopping and mincing and like that. It makes a lovely group activity it depends. If you've got that kind of group, if you've got the right group. Yes. And I'm talking for a minute because I have put down my glasses. Oh, they're there. It's kind of like, oh, hello, I'm about to give you the adventure recipe. Now, why is this an adventure recipe? Well, it's for the first part of it, it's because it has pork. Now, you can certainly use something that isn't pork, but use something that will shred and is tasty. That's the trick to it. You want to have something that is going to be incorporated with the rice into the mold. So that's the trick of it is to have either a meat. I know some of you guys always ask about tofu, and the answer is I don't think so. Although if you flavored it properly, I suppose you could dice it, and not shred it, not dice it, but make it small cubes, and not shred it because tofu doesn't shred, and it would make the proper consistency. I don't cook with tofu very much, and you'll have to kind of be adventurous and make it ahead of time and see if you think it works. Pardon me, but I'm going to call this a shredded pork mold because when we're all done, we're going to let it stand, and then we're going to invert it, put the plate on top, and then turn it over, and it will make not a tremendously firm mold, but a nice mold that people can cut into, and it won't make pie slices or something, but it is soft and delicious, but it will look very pretty on the plate. Okay, we're going to have 6 pounds of, I'm going to use pork. You can use lamb or beef type that will shred with a fork. The trick is that I'm going to shred the protein, I'm going to shred the meat. Yes, if you must use tofu, chicken. If you can't use pork or something that'll actually shred, maybe this recipe needs a little bit of practice. I don't know about chicken. It doesn't. You could flavor it. I suppose you can shred chicken. People are saying you can shred chicken with a fork. So yes, if you would like. 6 pounds of pork. We're going to say pork. 2 very large onions that we're going to dice. 3.5 cups of broth. I like to use beef stock. Yes. We're going to use kind of a lot of butter, like 1/2 cup of butter. 1/4 teaspoon of allspice. 1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon. We're going to use some salt and pepper because we're going to flavor it up. And then we're going to have a 16-ounce can of garbanzo beans. that we're going to drain and we're going to shell. That's or chickpeas, if you'd like. And we're going to make 1.5 cups of rice, uncooked. You know what I mean? To measure it, it's an uncooked rice, not cooked rice, 1.5 cups, because, of course, rice swells up. So I like to make this with pork. You can experiment and use something that will shred nicely, because otherwise it won't form properly. Okay, we're going to cover the meat and the onions with cold water, and we're going to cook them for about 2 hours until they're nice and tender. And as you go, if you're using pork or lamb or something that has fat that rises to the top of the water, skim it. So occasionally you have to look back at it because it's going to be cooking for a couple hours, and you skim the fat off, the balls of fat that show up, because we don't want them in our recipe. And then we're going to shred the meat. We're going to take it out, and we've cooked it with the onions. We're going to shred it, and we're going to make a nice pile of shredded. And then we're going to drain it, of course. And we're going to put the now shredded meat in the pot with the beef stock, the onions, the butter, and all the seasonings. And we're going to add the beans and the rice. If you have used canned beans, you might add them a little later, depending on their consistency, because you don't want them to fall apart. And we're going to give it a little bit of salting. And we're going to cook this whole thing for about 30 minutes over a medium flame. And you'll know that you're done when the rice is cooked and the broth water has evaporated. See? And so when it's all cooked through and the rice is done and and it's not watery, it's done. And it takes about 30 minutes. And you don't want to stir it at all because we're trying to form a mold, right? So when it's all cooked through and you've got the shredded meat and everything in there and it's all delicious and the rice is all cooked, you take it off the fire and you do what I always tell you to do when you have something that you want to be fairly firm. And you're going to set it aside and let it stand for about, well, not less than 5 minutes, maybe closer to 10. Just let it stand there. Don't stir it. Don't do anything to it. So it sets. It kind of comes together. Then we're going to do the trick where you put the plate on top or the serving dish. You invert the pot. You turn the pot over. And then you take the pot off it, and it makes a lovely mold. If you're going to carry this someplace, of course, you invert it when you get there, right? Right. Because otherwise, it's going to just fall apart. It's not that firm. But it will indeed make a very nice rice and shredded pork and onions and the allspice. But you see that this is the adventure recipe, because first of all, it's got several unusual things. It has allspice and cinnamon. And it's got pork. If you know that, of course, you have some guests, some participants who cannot eat pork for one reason or another, and there's lots of religious prohibitions about pork, then do something else. Use the shredded meat. Shredded lamb is particularly good. People are saying goat is a particularly good meat for that because it shreds up real nice. Yes, do something that is the right consistency. Otherwise, it will be absolutely delicious, because it's got all those lovely seasonings, but it will not invert properly. You're going to have to ignore the mold part. You're going to have to just serve it in the pot. Pardon me, I took a sip of water. And there's, of course, nothing wrong with that. It's just that it's kind of interesting when it comes out. Okay, so that's our adventure recipe. And you know what? I believe we have come to the end of another one of our shows. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to those of you who have returned. Thank you for those of you who are here for the first time. I loved having you. I hope that you learned something. I learned something, too. Thank you very much. If you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com, or book, you can look at our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. The last five episodes, the most recent five, are archived, the programs are archived on the website. The rest of them, including those five, are archived on the radio station, which is blogtalkradio.com/Recipe for Peace Now. Thank you very much, and I hope to have you come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.